For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, last week we were talking about the fact that when we read about creation in Genesis, there's more than one way to read it. And I think one of the best ways of thinking about it is what's called progressive creation. It's not necessarily just something that happened a few thousand years ago that could extend millions back, probably basically that the fossil record is correct and that the dating and the age of the Earth at 4.5 billion is correct, and the beginning of life at 3.8 billion is correct. And that perfectly fits with the narrative in Genesis 1, several different possible ways. Whether it's the fact that the days represent long ages, whether the days are just representative of different creative events where God comes in and adds to the biology on Earth. People say, well, why would he do it in parts like that? Why wouldn't he just do it all at once? Because one possibility is that the Earth had to be ready for the successive stages. For example, Earth's atmosphere has been dramatically changed from what it was in primordial times by the presence of life here. And so the levels of oxygen today in the world much higher than they would have been, you know, billions of years ago. And so just like in your garden, you put the lettuce in early, but you have to wait until later for the tomatoes and so forth. It could be something like that. Or is it just the sheer joy of creation that God just likes creating? But whatever the case, we do see those, you know, sudden jumps, and we went through some of that last week, so I'm not going to belabor that anymore. I ran out of time last week before we covered this view, young earth creationism. These people believe that it's all literal. You go to Genesis 1, there's 6 days of creation. Everything was created during those 6 literal days, one right after the other, including the whole universe. It's not just the earth. It's the whole universe is created 6 to 10,000 years ago. And then what happened is during the world flood described in Genesis 6, the fossil record got all messed up. Basically, it made the earth look a lot older than it really was because all of this moving water, you know, created vast pools of mud with, you know, dead creatures' bones in it. And then as it piled up, people thought, oh, well, that must have taken millions of years to make that pile. But it really happened in a very short period, a couple of years. Okay. Yeah, less than 10,000 years ago. The view is important mainly because this is the premier view held by fundamental Christianity today. And so whenever you see news, whenever you see specials that bring up the Christian view of creationism, the word creationism means, in modern parlance, this view, young earth creationism. It's always in front and center. They've got the microphone all the way. And I think part of this is that opponents of the Christian worldview actually like putting them out front and center because it makes the Christian view look stupid. Because this view is stupid. Completely discredited. I think that it is absolutely just a terrible misfortune that these guys have the mic and that's being viewed as the Christian view on creation. It's a disaster, catastrophe. First of all, their methodology is wrong. In young earth, and I'm sorry if you're a young earther, I'm just going to tell it the way I see it. I hope I don't hurt your feelings, but I think you should really listen to this and think about it. The methodology is wrong. The methodology for young earth is they reach a conclusion on what happened based on reading the Bible text. Then they go out and look and do data mining and drilling into various scientific accounts and discoveries around the world to try to find support for that. Okay, that's not how you do science. It's not how you do theology either. It's perfectly possible, the methodology that I would suggest is we find out how much breadth and room, a range of meaning can this text have, and then within that, what would be the most likely ones would be the ones that fit with what we're finding out in the real world. So, for example, John Lennox uses the example that you know, the church used to teach that the earth stood still and the sun went around. And when Galileo showed that this was not the case, they put him in prison and threatened to burn him at the stake. That's great. What an awesome religion. They just apologized to Galileo in my lifetime, in like the 1980s. The Vatican finally issued an apology. Whew, it's so rank. And then, of course, eventually the evidence kind of built up until it was just overwhelming that actually the earth is going around the sun. And Christians had to stop and think about, so where does the Bible teach that the earth, that the sun goes around the earth? And you know, going back and re-looking at it with new eyes, you realize it never says that. It uses expressions like the sun said, just like we do. Doesn't mean they believe that. And in fact, this belief in the earth-centric view came from Aristotle, not from the Bible. So you change your view of interpretation. I think we have an analogous thing going on here. One of the worst things about this movement is that they just won't respond. They're unresponsive to the falsifying data. For example, think of coral atolls in the Pacific, let's say. Coral is an organism, so it grows at a, you know, it is limited to how fast it can grow. To add more coral can take over 100 years for an inch of coral. And yet we have coral atolls that are more than a mile deep. Now how did that happen in under 10,000 years? That's millions of years right there. And it's not like it's a physical, you know, the whole thing about Morris, one of the founders of this, got the idea for young earth geology while he was spraying off his driveway and watching the sediment run off to the side. It's like, that's it. That's how it happened. No, that's not how it happened. What about light from different distant stars? We can see stars a billion light years away. Even further than that. So under this theory, God would have had to have created the universe and the stars and the light from those stars already coming our way. The intervening light would have had to have been created at the same time as the planet. And what would that say? I mean, I'm sure God would be able to do that, but why would he do it? I mean, it can only be interpreted one way, which is that the universe is billions of years old. And this would actually make God seem like a deceiver if he created it looking like that old when it's really not. A lot of types of rock sediment in the geology of Earth are very slow forming. They never form quickly. You think of gypsum or limestone. Very slow forming rock that is formed from shells and skeletons of animals. And so if you had what they say when he's spraying his hose and seeing sediment come down, that type of sediment is completely different than what you get in the bottom of an ocean. And it's immediately recognizable. You can get sandstones, but at an alluvial fence where a river comes down from the mountains and hits the plain, you'll see the sediments fanning out, and that's very similar to what Morris is proposing. You do a cross-section of that, it's nothing like what you would see, for example, in the Grand Canyon, where you see perfectly level rows of sediment, and even all the way across. That only happens at the bottom of an ocean in very slow sedimentation. It just simply doesn't fit their account. When backed into a corner, as Morris says, real creation necessarily involves the creation of an apparent age. An apparent age, they say, well, how old was Adam? How, you know, was he a boy? Was he a man? When he was created? Apparently he was a man. He got married. So, and yet he was only one day old. What about that? So he looked way older than he really was. Apparent age. Okay. Probably true, and I could see where some things might have some apparent age if God created them. But light from distant stars being here already? Or what about this one? The Greenland ice cores that have been dug to a depth of over a mile down into ice, these cores are banded, which clearly, right up to the present day, each year there's a new band because of the seasons. And so in the summer there's melting, and in the winter there's buildup. And it makes these bands that are very easy to see. And they go for 600,000 years. Now, okay, so if God wanted to said, well, I'd like to have an icy, area here, so I'm going to create a glacier. I can see it's going to boom. And so it's just been created. Why would he put the bands in there? There's no way. That can only mean one thing. And so again, we're picturing God as a deceiver, as somebody deliberately misleading. I really object to that. The Bible is clear that God cannot tell a lie. It's extremely truthful. And this would be a de facto lie right here. So you can read really good critiques. Some of you may have family members that are into this. Hugh Ross's book, Creation and Time, is probably the most recent. It's real solid. And he has really taken them apart. This whole view is just wrong. And we need to know that and be able to argue it. You will occasionally meet people from churches that teach this, and you're going to have to make the case and show them what to think about it. Okay, let's move on to this week's subject. The evidence of God's creation that comes from presuppositions. To presuppose means that this is my starting point. This is you got to begin somewhere in your thinking, and that's your axioms, your first principles, or your presuppositions. So I may presuppose that we're really here and that I'm seeing this as a real world. Okay, and so I'm just going to start there, and then I'm going to reason from that point. That's my presupposition. Everyone has presuppositions. They may not have ever thought about what they were, but you definitely have them. You have to have them, or else you just can't even think about anything. Assumptions. Here's the point in this argument, is that your assumptions, your beginning points, need to line up with your conclusions and be compatible, or else you got a problem. There's something wrong with your worldview. If you can't be consistent between your starting point and where things go from there, then your view's wrong somewhere. Especially if you're unable. It's not just that you aren't being consistent, but it's not even possible to be consistent. Then there must be something seriously flawed with your worldview. And that what we'll find is that worldviews like naturalism, like pantheism, like animism, are flawed, and they're wrong. And we can show this because their beginning point doesn't match their conclusion. And it's a very powerful argument. In fact, I'm quite taken with this. It's so powerful that it's almost inescapable if you understand it. It's a little hard to understand, a little harder than some other arguments to understand, but we'll see what we can do here tonight. The Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, on the other hand, perfectly matches everything we see. The beginning points and the conclusions line up absolutely as you would expect. And that is a sign of truthfulness. Internal consistency is necessary for a worldview to be truthful. It's not the only thing. You need other things in addition, but you definitely need internal consistency. When we open our Bibles to Romans 1, Paul says of God, that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. When we look into ourselves, in our mind, we see something there that tells us we are the products of special creation. They tell us, in fact, just exactly what we read here in Genesis 1:26. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and of the cattle, and over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created him. In the image of God. It doesn't mean we physically look like God. It means we have the same qualities that God has in terms of being a spiritual being, in terms of being a personal being. This is one of the most important things in the Bible to understand. You just can't understand any of the rest of what we're talking about in Scripture unless you understand this notion of being created in the image of God. It's like a critical link. And it flatly contradicts naturalism. This is one of those places where, as we think about the naturalistic worldview, that there is no God and that the supernatural is phony, it doesn't exist, and theism, the belief that there is a God and that the supernatural realm is real, here we come into direct conflict, and it's really to the detriment of the naturalist. Let's see why. You know, a lot of times you're interacting with people, and you'll notice that sometimes people say they think one thing, but their life is totally different. And a lot of times, so we have the saying that, you know, actions speak louder than words, because if somebody is acting in a way that's totally contradictory to what they say they believe, that's usually called hypocrisy. It's something that nobody finds very attractive. And it's really a sign that something's gone seriously wrong. It could be that you're confused, that you haven't thought about it, you don't realize the contradiction is there. Or it could be that you're lying, that you're being dishonest. That is a definite possibility, especially when it comes to this subject. So, suppose you know somebody who says, gravity has no effect on me whatsoever. And, you know, it affects other people, but I just figured out how to master it. Then you go... You go flying with him, and he's got a parachute on. And you're like, hey, dude, what's with the parachute? I thought you should just be able to walk out of this plane and float. You wouldn't even have to worry about it. He's like, yeah, that's right. He's like, this, yeah, I just wear this. I think it's cool. And you're just like, oh, my God. That's horse crap. Stop lying. Okay, here's another friend, says he's very concerned about the environment. He's really green, very worried about what's happening to the earth. Then later you notice him emptying his car oil into the stream out in back of his house. You're just like, is he really so ignorant that he wouldn't know that that's bad for the environment? Or is this whole talk about being environmentally engaged just a lie? Either possibility, but it's definitely not. I mean, there's definitely a problem in that type of contradiction. So I want to give you my favorite illustration on this, which I use in my book, Discovering God. You can read more about it there if you want. Get your free copy. So there's a little story. Here a lady and a dude are riding on a train in a dining car. Train pulls into a station and stops. They look out the window and they see this, a hillside with these rocks. There's rocks all over the hillside, but some of them have been gathered together, apparently, into what roughly resembles the words, the Canadian Railway welcomes you to Canada. Well, the lady's sitting there and she's like, wow, I can't believe they did that. That took a lot of work. Those are big stones. And the dude's like, well, I don't think they necessarily did that. I think it could be an accident. After all, there are other, you can see there's other stones, and it is a slope, so they apparently, you know, they're going to occasionally roll down. The energy's sufficient, the material's available, and so, you know, sooner or later, this is bound to happen, that they would just come into that shape. It's accidental. Okay, well, you know, she'd be like, okay, so you're kidding, right? How ignorant would you have to be to believe that could happen by accident? And he's like, well, just think how many hillsides there are around. There's probably thousands of hillsides like this. I mean, it's not going to happen on all of them, but I mean, at least once, I could easily see this happening. Well, it's nowhere near the complexity of the molecular biology we were studying last week, right? Which would dwarf this a billion times over in complexity. But still, it's plenty complex that I would feel, you know, just flabbergasted and frankly pretty skeptical that anyone actually even believes that. He's probably just giving me some crap, right? And so we have the argument from design. This is what we talked about last week. But, and notice, in addition, the features of design are here. And they must have been placed there by somebody who has to be a thinking, planning, willful being. That is, a personal being. An impersonal force would not create something like that. It has to be someone thinking, planning, yeah, let's do this, and then making it happen. Humans doing it, most likely candidate. Whoever made this formation of rocks, for one thing, speaks English, right? That's English. That's unmistakable. And had to have formed a plan beforehand. And then, so there's intentionality. There's somebody thinking. There's somebody planning. There's somebody making an intention and executing it, having enough power to make it happen. And you can infer all those things from just looking at the formation. Here, so it's really a mind. Yeah, that's a mind. That's person, personal being. Here's a critical question, very important. How close is this thing to the Canadian border? If we find out that that train station and hill are right at the U.S.-Canadian border, it's over, right? Because that's external referentiality, exactly what we were talking about last week. It's referring to something outside of itself. That would just happen to happen right on the Canadian U.S. border, you'd have to be a complete fool to believe that. Nobody would believe that. And so the argument from design is very powerful. But let's take it now to the next level and think about the argument from presuppositions. This is a different argument. As they're sitting there, the dude gets up and he says, hey, we should run into the station and change our cash over to Canadian. She's like, and why would we do that? He's like, can't you read? He points out the window, can't you read? We're coming into Canada. All right. Now think about that. No. You just said this formation was a chance, you know, accidental rolling down of rocks. Now you're saying that it has meaning and it means we're at the Canadian border. You can't say both of those things. Your presupposition that this is an accidental, random event that happened is incompatible with your claim now that it has a message in it and that it means something real to us today. You see that, right? Yeah. Cannot have it both ways. Accidental, yet it still means something. By definition, if it's accidental, it's random, it can't have an intended meaning in it. And so we'll find that this is true in one area after another. Let's think through a few areas tonight. The analogy, I'm sure you see, the belief that that formation was a product of random rocks rolling down the hillside. No guiding mechanism aiming them to where they need to be is analogous to completely naturalistic explanation that this world and people in it and life and everything else has just happened by accident. It just kind of happened. There's no creator. And so, as argued last week, I think that's extremely unlikely argument from design. Fabulously unlikely. But we could say theoretically, let's say that that's possible. But you can't turn around then and draw conclusions that are only compatible with special creation. like this. Does your life have any meaning or any value? Do you matter that you're here? Answer, only if you're the product of creation. If you and the rest of us are all the product of an accident that happened, of molecules colliding and bonding, nobody guiding anything, no supernatural or spiritual content to anything, all matter and energy under physical law, then how can you actually mean something? Whether you're going to die pretty soon, so you were here, then you died, and you're not here anymore, and it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't affect anything. The world goes right on as if you had never been here, or were here, disappeared, same thing either way. This happens millions of times over, billions of times. People are like, no, you can still have meaning. Really? What is it? What's the meaning? There's no answer. It's absolutely arbitrary to try to manufacture meaning out of a model which by definition has no meaning. Wasn't planned, wasn't brought here with a purpose, and so has to be essentially meaningless. Let me give you a saying. If it is chance that made that happen, then you cannot turn around and say, oh, it's all so meaningful. Now, when we turn to the biblical worldview, we think our lives are meaningful because they were created by God. Created by God in His image. That, in fact, we have the capacity to outlive our bodies. That there's a dimension put into humans, a spirit, a soul, a non-material mind that's different than the brain. There's a brain and a mind, two different things. They work together, sure. Your body, so we have an animal component, a physical body that's like other animals in a lot of ways. But there's something else in there, me, the person, the being. And that me, we believe, will survive the death of my physical body. That could never happen under a materialistic model. How would we jump from matter to non-material? Darwinism sure doesn't explain that. Darwinism is about change in physical structures in your body. Morality, let's think about that. Is there such a thing as a right and a wrong? We have a piece of paper and the wind comes along and blows it. And it falls down. Is that a good event or an evil event? It's a silly question. How can it be moral? It's just matter, energy from the wind, and physical law like gravity. I mean, it's just matter reacting to gravity, or physical law. It's not moral. It just is. That's something that just happened. Right? Correct. So, you know, if a tree falls down, it's not evil tree, it's just a tree. Now, the problem is, for the naturalistic worldview, everything is matter and energy reacting to physical law. Not just a piece of paper, but you and me are in that category as well. You can't take matter and physical law and change that into morality, where something is right and something is wrong. And that creates quite a few problems for naturalistic thinkers. They should be saying, well, whatever happens, that happens is right. Whatever is, and it needs to be. It's inevitable. It's just a cause and effect chain of material causes and effects. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just the world in which we live. Peter Singer has grasped this. He's a moral philosopher at Princeton, professor of ethics there. He says the foundations of this view that humans are different than other animals have been knocked asunder. We can no longer base our ethics on the idea that human beings are a special form of creation made in the image of God, singled out from all other animals and alone possessing an immortal soul. Well, obviously he doesn't believe in the biblical view, right? He's a noted animal rights advocate. And, you know, under naturalism, he's basically saying for humans to say, well, we're different than the rest of the animal world, is arrogant. We're taking on airs. He calls it speciesism. Instead of racism, it's speciesism. We think our species is better. Well, the problem is, when equalizing the animal order and humans, we haven't really raised the animals. We've lowered the human. That's what's happened. He goes on, he says, our better understanding of our own nature has bridged the gulf that was once thought to lie between ourselves and other species. So why should we believe that the mere fact that a being is a member of the species Homo sapiens endows its life with some unique, almost infinite value? Because it does. Because we do have a spirit. We are created in the image of God. Here's John Gray, a British professor. He says, over the past 200 years, philosophy has not given up Christianity's cardinal error, the belief that humans are radically different from other animals. That's really interesting. So, I look out here and I see a couple of dogs get into a dog fight, and maybe one of them wastes the other one and he dies. How immoral is that? So that's just no different than me killing one of you or some person that's annoying me. I can just kill that person. And what would be the difference? I mean, we don't chide the dog. We don't say, you're going to have to go to prison for this. You know? Get a spanking for that. It's just a dog. Okay? We all know that. We intuitively know that we are morally culpable, moral agents, free-choosing moral agents. An animal is not moral. Guppies, fish, eat their young. If you ever have guppies, you got to separate them as soon as they give birth because they'll eat all of them up. A moral outrage? Hardly. It's just nature. And so what we end up with is not a new equality of morality. We end up with no morality under this picture. Now, on the other hand, if you look at things from a biblical point of view, we believe that the infinite personal creator God imbued us with the freedom to choose and made us as moral beings because he's moral. So there's a source. It's not the physical aspects of our bodies or anything like that. It's imbued at the same point where we're created in the image of God. Of course, it doesn't mean we live morally. We have the sense, we have a certain sense that some things are just flat wrong. We think, what about some creep that grabs a little 4-year-old girl, rapes her and murders her? Something that happens periodically. Is that just something that happened? Or is that just plain wrong? Well, and at the same time, we need to ask the question, is it wrong because our society has gotten together and said, let's just make that wrong? Or is it just actually wrong regardless of what our culture says and thinks? Yeah, it's that, the latter one. You know, in some cultures, you can rape and kill a person as long as they're your slave and do whatever you want. They don't see anything wrong with it. So this is not something that's a consensus, that humans come up with this consensus. It's something that we know intuitively because of our makeup as moral beings, as beings created in the image of God, that some things are just plain wrong. And, you know, the society may recognize that or not. But that's the way it is. This is a standard above society. Pantheism, the belief that God is everything, really has a problem with morality as well. Here's a worldview that's saying there is a God, but it's not the personal God of the Bible. It's an impersonal God who imbues all things. Under pantheism, And we think of a saintly person, let's say, like Mother Teresa. God's part of her. She's God, part of God. But Adolf Hitler would also be part of God. It's not just the good. The evil is just as much a part of God as the bad. Or the good. Yeah, whatever. It's a huge problem in pantheistic thinking. And many Zen masters, for example, are on record as saying people who dwell on good and evil is the sickness of the mind. You have to understand the harmony when you see the yin and the yang. Yeah, there's suffering, there's murder, there's beautiful things too, and it's all a big harmony. You just need to harmonize all things. Boy. Let's look at a different area. This is called human dignity. The fact that people matter more. You have a mosquito on you. Are you going to smack it? Could kill that mosquito. That's a living organism. That's an animal. You just killed an animal. Or are you going to eat an onion? So you're ending the life of this organism. It's an organism also. Is that permissible? Yeah, I think it is. I think we all pretty much would agree that these really not bad. It's a good that you get the mosquito, right? One less mosquito to worry about. So why then wouldn't we be willing to kill humans the same way? They're annoying. Somebody's sucking my blood figuratively by, you know, costing me too much money or whatever. Boom! Keep the change. What's wrong with that? Why is it that we know killing mosquitoes okay, killing the human is not allowed? There's really no answer that comes back from an ethicist like Peter Singer. And he's being more consistent, frankly, than a lot of atheist thinkers are. They'll be like, no, you can still have morality and be an atheist. Well, yeah, you can make something up and say, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, yeah, that's right, and this is wrong. Completely arbitrary. Not objective in any way. And so it's almost like a word game. There is no true moral good and evil have to be independent of what we decide arbitrarily make good and evil. A lot of people, including atheists, believe this, that all people are equal. Doesn't the Bill of Rights say all people are created equal under God? Well, of course, they would take the God part out, but they would definitely still believe that you should treat all people equal. And so think about that, okay. Why are we equal? What's equal about us? She's a woman, I'm a man. That's not equal, okay? I'm 6 feet tall, she's 5'6". That's not, 5'6" does not equal 6, all right? My skin's white, her skin's black. That's not equal. You know, I got blue eyes, she got brown eyes. How are we equal? What is it that's equal about us? I'm old, she's young. That's not equal. What you realize is that equality, we talk about equality and fairness to all people, it's not based on physical equality, is it? In fact, even if somebody was badly handicapped, in a wheelchair, maybe near death, we believe that we would need to care for that person just like anyone else. And we know that that's right. We all know it. Some of us might try to deny it. Some of us will deny it, but we all know it in our hearts. And God warns us in Jeremiah that the heart of man is desperately wicked and deceitful above all else, lying to others and even to ourselves. He says, who can understand it? It's like really nonsensical. But we know that there is an equality and that people have to be treated equally, and yet physically they're not equal. So what is equal about them? It's that other dimension. It's the soul. It's the spiritual person that is in there, the non-material. That's what makes us equal. And it's in that handicapped person just like it is in anyone else, and that's why we would want to, that's why we feel that we have to take care of each other. We cannot just go around killing humans or harming them in various ways. And so we have human dignity. But without that non-physical dimension. This is just all nonsense. This is pure. We're basically just like the guy on the train saying, let's go change our money because we're here in Canada. We're taking a stand that is flatly contradictory to our claimed belief system. Total inconsistency, total hypocrisy, and we don't care. Now, on the other hand, when someone from a biblical worldview, they say humans are significant, it's because of what we just read, that God created them in his own image, that God created humans on a very lofty level. And to understand what this image of God is, it's going to take us a little bit longer. We're going to study this for a couple more weeks because it's quite interesting and vastly affects how we live our lives today, directly applicable. So I hope you'll keep coming out and studying with us. This is an important point that as personal beings, it's not just that we're more significant in a good sense. It could be also in an evil sense. A personal being on the high level of created in the image of God, once that person turns away from God and severs the connection between God and the creature, becomes worse than any other creature. And we've got an excellent case to make that when we look at humanity, we're looking at a species so vicious, so incredibly destructive, self-destructive and others destructive, and destructive of the world, that there's got to be something wrong with them. And yet, unlike other animals who might be aggressive once in a while, whatever, this is just a whole different level. To kill millions of our own species in a factory-like manner, it's like, well, where do you get that? How can you get that level of evil? It's because we're very lofty beings. And when we're lofty, good, we can do a lot of good. But when we turn away from God, terrible things are going to happen. Worse than any other creature on earth. And that really fits the picture, frankly. Well, let me give you a little saying to remember. When it comes to significance, when it comes to you being a person who matters, who needs to be treated as important. If you end up as nothing, which is exactly what naturalism teaches, right? You're going to die, you won't remember that you ever lived, there is no you anymore, and you are basically nothing at that point. And so I'm saying, if you're going to end up as nothing, then you are nothing. In essence, you started out of nothing. Pretty soon you're going to be nothing, and really the whole whatever happens in between is also nothing, ultimately. We can go to a beach like the one we were at this past week and file down in there until we get a single grain of sand on the tip of the finger. Is that a significant grain of sand? If that was put into a furnace and blown away, would that be significant? What is the significance? It's not significant. It's just matter. And so we have a huge disconnect with naturalism. So do we with pantheism, too. And I'm just picking on pantheism tonight because a lot of people are pantheists and they think it's awesome. Well, pantheism actually has a huge problem with human dignity. You know, they believe that the things that happen to people and where they are in their state in life is all the result of karmic law from a previous life. That's why, for instance, in India, where there's 200 million Dalits, people who are excluded from normal society, absolutely uneducated, nobody will help them, desperately poor, and it's all because under their system, that's their karma. They deserve this. So to try to change that and then would just be totally unenlightened and really foolish. And so humans and the idea that all humans are equal, that is not what most religions teach. They sure don't teach that women and men are equal at all. Under Hinduism, a woman can't even go to heaven, to moksha. The best she can get is to reincarnate as a man. That's her best hope. Wow. So it really does make a difference where your presuppositions start is going to determine where you come out, isn't it? Freedom. Freedom. To be a free choosing person. Am I a machine? that is just being determined. Okay, we think of, you've probably done this back in grade school, they put the soda and pour the vinegar in there and you get a certain amount of foaming up, and so it's a chemical reaction, right? Well, we can do that over and over again. Every time we do it, we get exactly the same result. Never any variation, not even the slightest bit. If the quantities are the same, the conditions are the same, we will get exactly the same outcome. And science could tell us down to a millionth of a gram how much CO2 is going to be emitted, and it will be exactly that way every single time. There is no free choice in this model. The soda isn't sitting there thinking, well, I think I will react this time. But I'm not, nah, I don't feel like it. There's no free choice here. This is a rigid, mechanistic event that's happening. And of course, it's very simple. Other reactions are more complicated, but they're the same way. It's still chemicals reacting with each other. It's an electromagnetic event, attraction event, and it's happening all over the universe. The problem is then, if the whole universe is matter and energy like naturalism claims, and natural law, and the physical laws, then it too is a machine, and that would include us. We're part of that too, under naturalism. And so this cause and effect wheel moving forward really determines every outcome, including every thought you've ever had, is a part of that deterministic cause and effect chain. And so therefore, you're not really thinking. It just seems like you're thinking. But in fact, your brain chemistry, you know, it's cells, it's electrical impulses at the synapse, and neurotransmitters, it's all matter. And it operates and functions under the laws of that govern chemistry. Think of a watch. There's no freedom in this. The teeth have to fit into each other and the wheels turn as they're made to turn. This is a deterministic machine. It's not deciding what to do. There's no freedom. And under naturalism, this is what we all are. Yeah, we're more complicated than that machine, but we're still a machine. And so how do you get, how can you, if you can't think freely, then how are you reaching conclusions that are valid? How are you weighing evidence and coming up with any conclusions whatsoever? The only thing that would be consistent with naturalistic assumptions is just to forget about, nothing matters, no reason to ever try to persuade anybody, no reason to try to change anybody, because everything is just going to go forward in its deterministic path. So, how could we have morality if everyone's determined to do what they do? It's not their fault. They didn't decide. That's just what they're chemically and environmentally, biologically determined to be. You can't have meaningful love under that model. You can't have anything matter. Ultimately, nothing matters because, again, this whole machine is churning out people and events in a completely random, unthinking way, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. We all know that's not the way things are, though. We know that we really are thinking. We know that we do have a measure of freedom. Every time we see that rapist, that killer, child killer on TV, we're like, get him! Somebody who's a racist, spitting out hate, and we're like, man, that is wrong, that is so wrong! And so we know that we should just be saying under naturalism, well, he's doing what he's conditioned to do. He has no choice. Why get worked up about it? And yet we know that's, so it's that inability, again, to live in accordance. Now, of course, as believers, Bible believers, we argue that humans were created with the capacity to make free decisions. We'll get into that next week. And that non-material part of us, the soul, the mind, isn't subject to physical law, like our molecules are, our physical part of our body is subject to physical law, but the mind and the soul are not, because they're non-material. That's crucial to being able to conceive of beings having a freedom to say, hey, I'll say yes or I'll say no, and they're not fooling themselves. Now, of course, our freedom is not complete. It's not even as much as we should have, because our freedom got impaired pretty badly during the fall, but it's still there in a significant degree, and it's there to the amount, for instance, that we are culpable when we do something immoral or wrong, and we're responsible for that. One last area, spirituality. Are you going to survive your death? Is there an afterlife? Is there something, someone in you that's not just the cells, that is actually goes beyond that? If so, that could only be true under a creation model by a spiritual, personal God. If we accept everything that neo-Darwinism teaches, all it could say is that it explains how our bodies have modified. There's nothing there. Mutation and survival of the fittest has nothing to do with creating a non-material being out of matter, okay? And so it is necessary, absolutely, if you reject the idea of a personal creator, then you have to also reject the idea of a soul. Natural resulting in the supernatural? I don't think so. And so, to naturalists, a human is no more spiritual than a grasshopper. Literally, neither one of them have the slightest amount of spirit or soul in them. Pantheism has a problem with this area as well. Now, they believe that everything that's happening in life is the result of karmic law, like I said earlier. So you might have freedom in terms of what your next life is going to be, but what this life is all been determined already in the previous life. And so they literally don't believe that humans have any freedom. All right. Now, who can follow this logic? There's many other areas we could speak of, but you get the drift. When we believe that people are meaningful, that they're significant, that they're free, that they're moral, all the things that we intuitively know they are, none of that is compatible with naturalism, and we have to accept that a purposeful God created us this way. There's no other valid answer that would have this result. All of these things are totally incompatible with a chance, random origin, like rocks rolling down the hill during a rainstorm. Would never lead to this, cannot lead to this conclusion. And therefore, if we believe these things about people, and we should because they're all true, and we do because we intuitively sense it, then we have to eject naturalism as false and accept the implications of our beliefs, which it can be traced back to a personal, spiritual origin for humans. How you view the origin of humans totally controls how you view the nature of humans. And these are locked together irrevocably. And I think that our actions show the fact that all of us, not just theists, but everyone, actually gets morally outraged when they see that evil, moral, and immoral action shows that we all really know that we were created in that we saw in Romans 1:19 that says God has made himself evident within us. I look into me and I realize what I see there is not compatible with naturalism. It's way higher than anything naturalism could deliver. And therefore it must be from someone who is super above the natural, namely God. Who is he? What's he like? How can you get to know him? How can you be with him forever? One idea would be start tonight by calling out to him and just saying, you know, I've got a lot of questions here. I'm not saying I'm a person of faith, but I sure am interested, and I would like, if I can know you, I think I'd be pretty interested in that. Just do that. What harm is that going to do? The principle is, if I take a step toward God, he'll take a step toward me. And God will show himself to you because he's a God of love. He wants to be with you. So if you have an opening to this, express that to him and take your search to him. And also, you should plan on coming back for some more Genesis, because we're going to answer all these questions in the next few weeks. All right. We'll start next week with a detailed look into that notion of in the image of God. What does that actually mean? Yeah, God, we're so thankful that we are created in your image. That we are not just worms. We are people. That we can know you. That our life goes on. That we do have significance. We are moral beings. All these things. We can tell that it's true, and now we can see the reason why. It all goes back to your creation of the humans. And thank you that we don't have to put our brains on the shelf to come into faith. That in fact, the faith that you're calling us to makes more sense than any other view we could get to. That's awesome. I pray for people here tonight who are really giving this a second look, God, and that they would maybe just admit that to you, that they're open and they want to know more. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.